Now we have Ethan here with us, and Ethan, thank you for coming. We're really glad that you came out here. So to start off, I had some questions about the process for you. When you went into this, what was the story you're trying to tell? Like, why did you have to tell this story? I guess is what I'm really getting at. Because just to kind of build up here, now with short films, your avenues of distribution, very small, you know, unless you're like a Pixar film and there's like a short before, you know, short films either go into film festivals or they go online and maybe they become someone's reel. But there's something still great about short films. I love to make them myself. And what is it about this story that you had to tell?
Well, first of all, thank you, Rick and Mark, for having me on your show.
You're welcome.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And just going ahead, it's, you know, it's our pleasure to have just filmmakers, especially local filmmakers in our show, just to spread the word, to kind of talk about the people who are really doing it, you know, show some Brooklyn love. So if you are a local filmmaker and you think we're the kind of guys you might want to get grilled by, like Ethan's about to be here, definitely let us know. Get in touch. We will be happy to take a look at your film. Send it in. We'll let you know where. We'll take a look at the film. We'll definitely get back to you. At least give you some pointers if we're feeling it's not for us. But please, definitely get in touch. We'd love to represent.
Yes. So, Ethan, Saltwater, I got to tell you, I really enjoyed it. But back to what was it about the film that you just had to get out there, that you wanted to get out to people?
Well, originally Saltwater was just a small writing exercise for me, just to see what I could do with a very limited scope.
Okay.
And it just sort of got bigger over time. And then some stuff happened in my life. Some people I know had died, and it really affected me. And I decided I wanted to really take this concept of these two survivors after a nuclear war, just make it big, see where it goes. And it was a short film. It was 9 pages.
Okay.
It's currently sitting at like near 30 minutes running time, which is strange, but it's slowly paced, so it makes sense.
Is that something you would say just before, I'm sorry to cut in, is there something you would say is natural for an earlier cut for a film to be, especially a short film, to be longer? Why do you think it is sitting at 30 minutes? Because as those of us who have dabbled in short films, as all three of us have, we know that there is a preferred length, as much as we hate to admit, and it's about 9 to 12, 13 minutes. And doing something longer than that, it does cut out a number of festivals you could send it to. And obviously, we're talking about an earlier cut of Saltwater. There is a cut of Saltwater in the future. It's going to be maybe shorter, maybe longer. That's a part of the creative process, and that's something that's between Ethan and his film. But why do you feel like a lot of short films end up being longer when you're first getting started?
Well, I feel like the main problem is that you write a sentence on the page, and it says, you know, chase happens or gunfight happens or he runs down somewhere. But it takes one sentence on the page, but it could take a minute of screen time sometimes. And you have to really think about that when you write your films, because all your actions are going to take longer. But Saltwater was designed to be a long piece.
Like longer than, let's say, 10 to 12 minutes. So we're talking about like the festival, the short festival time, which I guess a lot of festivals, like 13 minutes, right
give
around
or take,
there.
Give or take.
Yeah, festivals usually like that film, 10, yeah.
Yeah.
30-minute film can get hard at a festival just because they're trying to put in a lot of short films into a pre-selected time period. But yeah, all three of us have seen Saltwater. Ethan, by nature, I hope you have seen your film.
Ooh, I can't remember watching it, no.
Oh, I see. Well, that said, it does maintain that pacing. It is also gorgeously shot. We'll talk about that later. But there is a definite stillness of pacing. And just going back to that, you were talking about what you drew on to make the film. So is that pacing part of the kind of fallout, no pun intended, it is a post-apocalyptic short, and we'll get into that later as well. Is that part of the fallout that you were experiencing with the emotional things that were going on in your life and how it affected how you were going to structure the screenplay, how you were going to tell your story, and what the fates of Mars and Floyd, who are the two main characters we meet in the film, were going to be?
Oh, definitely. I mean, a story like this has to be told kind of slow. You don't really want a lot of talking. What you want is you want your actors to express everything through body language, through their eyes. The less they say, the more real it is. So I understood that I was going to have long takes. There are some scenes that are just one single shot. Camera moves, camera follows. Sometimes the camera doesn't move.
Now, you're talking about stylistically, you used a lot of long takes, some camera movement. And I have to tell you, a great opening shot. Mm-hmm. I just want everyone, the film isn't up online. It will be online. We'll discuss that later. But there's this great opening shot, tracks through. And it's
derelict building, just splattered with graffiti. And it inspires me to use beautiful words to describe it. But no, it's a pan. It's a gorgeous pan that kind of uses a window, what used to be a window, to box in the characters. And it's just such a great way to introduce the space that they'll be spending most of the film in. I mean, sorry, Rick.
No, is it a track pan? Is that what we're working with here?
Well, it's actually a pan on a slider.
Cheaters.
There is a zoom lens attached, but unfortunately there were some production problems and that friggin'
there's always production problems.
It seems like you compensated for that really well.
Yeah, that zoom just, well, it worked when it wanted to work. I would like to say thank you, Ari, for donating that zoom to my film. True story, they donated it. Didn't work.
Ari, the camera company. Wow, yes.
Nice.
And
so
you shot it on the Red. You used the Red one?
The Red one with the MX sensor, yes.
Okay. And so just so everyone knows, this is the same camera that was used to shoot Social Network. We're not going to go into that film because that's another can of worms.
And Ethan was working with a significantly smaller budget in the Social Network. Yeah, that's all I have to say on that. yes, it is possible to make a short film. And no, we're not going to ask Ethan how much money went into the film because that's not the best question to ask a filmmaker. Even filmmakers who made $100 million movies will neglect to say it. So suffice to say, whatever went into it was hopefully enough. It does look great. It really has, I mean, what I feel is a kind of visual power that doesn't come from a lot of short films. It doesn't look like it's scrimping. I'm like, just off screen, there's a tiny crew just kind of barely making it by. It seems like there were a lot of talented people who put in time and effort, and there was some sort of funding that got the film through. And for something that looks more expansive, as in taking place in a larger space than it is, it's really effective.
Well, that's actually, I got to tell you, now you're using the word expansive. One thing, Ethan, I wanted to talk to you about is the characters, as Mark touched on, are in this small space for a lot of the film. I know the main character does wander out and explore, and that is like something in the film, but then you go back to this really tight space, and it kind of, I hate to bring up a parallel, but it had like a Fritz Lang feel where these characters are just trapped in this space, and it's like that closed frame, and I feel like you did a great job working with that, and I just wanted you to maybe talk about like the look you were going for with the film and everything. Like,
well, it was a combination of trying to do a style like that, of keeping the outside world kind of big, but the inside a little small. But then there was also some production problems, again, like when we ran out of daylight. We shot some night for day.
Okay.
A couple, like two of the scenes are shot at night. You can't really tell.
Now, were you using like HMI lights or what kind of light? I don't mean to get too technical on everyone, but this is a major part of the production process, and so just...
Well, we were using two 1.8 HMIs.
Okay.
As well as two 400 to 800 Jokers.
Okay.
And a couple of Leicos, like an 8x8 frame. This is for everything, that we just pretty much used the exact same equipment. It was very, very minimally lit, but very specifically lit.
Now, Mark, you... Sorry, what were you going to say?
That's all right. I was saying, or was going to... No, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I lost my train of thought. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, one thing, you know, you're saying you're using minimal light, but a lot of people, when they hear minimal light, they think of, like, you know, the low-key, low-fill, or, well, I guess technically, you know, high-key, low-fill lighting. But you didn't actually go that route. You know, everything is, like, really well illuminated, and you see all the detail, and it just... I mean, it looks great, and I just want to definitely give you props for that, because I feel like, you know, as filmmakers starting out, there's a major kind of like urge to do things a certain way. Maybe you saw a film in film school or this and that, and you seem to have gone away from that. Now, do you plan to always work in science fiction?
Well, I do love science fiction. I don't always want to do it, though, but it's sort of what comes naturally to me right now. And I do want to talk about the cinematography in the film.
Okay.
Whereas my cinematographer, Greta Zazula, me and her talked a lot about what we wanted to achieve. But at the end of the day, I just let her do what she wanted to do. Because I understood she knew exactly what I wanted. We shared the same vision. And she amazed me most of the time. Because sometimes I didn't know how it was going to look until I literally got there and I saw it.
But you had done a lot of conversation previously to this.
Oh, though. Yes.
Okay, so when you got there...
Hours and hours of it.
And that's the key, though.
Just drawing... Just literally sometimes having to just draw the whole space and figuring out where we want the sun to be. It actually affected when we shot certain scenes. Because we wanted the sunlight to come in and try to use as much of it as possible.
Mm. Now, when you talk about, you know, you gave a lot of trust to the DP. Were you more focused on speaking with the actors? Was that... something you were into, or just could you kind of talk about that process? I myself, I've done some work. Mark has also done a few films.
Sure.
And that's one thing for me, at least, that's always, you know, coming out of film school, I'm always a little, hesitant to just run right up to the actors.
I prefer to speak to the actors.
So anytime there was something on set that happened, actors always took priority to me, to the point where there were some times where my DP was like, you know, get the hell over here. Like, I need you to, like, look at this shot. And I was like, hold on, I need to talk to Rinaldi, who played the main character Mars in the film.
Okay.
Excellent.
I worked with Rinaldi a lot on this. Before the casting, I told him, I want you to get this part.
Could you talk about casting other actors too after Rinaldi?
Oh, yeah, okay. Sure. So I told him, like, he had read the script like a couple months before. He went with me to actually location scout because I need someone to stand in so we could take photos, just to see what this thing was going to even look like. And I told him, I want you to get the part. Wow me. So audition time came, and the first time he came in, he was sick as a dog. He still came into the audition. And his performance was, you know, not that great. But I gave him a second chance for callbacks, and he just impressed the hell out of me. And I knew. He knew exactly what I wanted. He did enough research on everything that could apply to his character. He... lost 20 pounds. He grew a beard. He stopped cutting his fingernails.
That's just kind of gross.
Serious commitment.
He looked a little like a homeless person because we covered him in dirt during the film.
No, the dirt does play like a major character. Like, yes. You might have to credit it at some point.
It's pretty. It's a dirty little movie.
No Philip Seymour Hoffman appearances. No,
well, the dirt was played by Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Oh, okay.
Well,
that works. Ethan, you had worked with the lead actor before, right?
And yes.
So you'd built up trust, I'm guessing, over time, and then...
Well, we had become friends. We had worked on a few, like, little projects that I had done in film school. And, you know, we became friends. We stay friends to this day. And I love working with him when I can, because he's phenomenal. And when it comes to casting the other actors, like you had asked...
Yes.
So there's two other characters in the film. Floyd and... spoiler, Rhodes. Yes, it's a bit of a spoiler because you're not supposed to know there's other characters.
We'll leave it out how and when certain characters are introduced. See the film.
Yes, hypothetically, if there were...
Right.
If there were other characters...
Who would they be played by?
Yeah.
And do these people have names?
So what I did with Floyd was I brought in older actors, some younger actors... And I gave them a bunch of different improv things to do just to see if they could understand the kinds of emotions I wanted to get out of them. And Mark was actually there during some of my casting sessions.
A bias, I was the casting assistant, glorified, or not really. But we saw a lot of younger and older guys. That's actually what brings Ethan here. He's a good friend of mine, but I also knew that he had made Saltwater because I had worked on it in casting sessions, and the younger guys just were not getting it. They just weren't. We had people jumping and rolling and ducking around the room, acting like it was a hard zombie movie, all high octane. One guy ripped one of his pant legs accidentally, and then he was just like, it's all right, let's do this, I'm ready. And, you know, it was an accident, and we liked the enthusiasm, but that's not who Floyd is supposed to be. That's enough said. I think that gives you a good example. And the older gentlemen who came in were more older. Just basically, they had a different kind of emotional maturity that made them
The word I would use would be subtle.
Were they more subtle? Some were. Yeah. We had some angry French men.
Whoa. Who came in. Pascal was singular. Fantastic.
Yes. And if he's listening to this by some weird twist of fate, I'm sure we might cast you again.
He was great.
You were good.
He was my second choice for Floyd, but he brought this like kind of like I'm French. You guys don't mind if I curse on your show, right?
No.
Just a couple of times.
He kind of brought this, you know, the world is shit, fuck it kind of thing. And while it was good, it wasn't what I really wanted for the character.
Mm.
So when I saw Scott Baird, and
Scott Baird, great name for this role.
I realized
great name, better actor.
What I had realized is that this person was exactly who I wrote. In his everyday life, that's who he
was.
He was the character.
When you see the film, you'll realize that is not a good thing. But it was good for the film.
Yeah, I know. The performance, I just felt like, I guess subtle would be the word. It's subtle. It's nuanced. It's
depressing.
A great performance. Well, you know.
It is hard to watch. It's hard to watch. Not in a bad way. Not like time was on the room. But just hard to watch because he's in a very different extreme as opposed to Mars, and that kind of dynamic is what drives the film. So tell us more about Scott Baird,
great guy. I worked with him a couple of times in preparation for the film. We had met, we got drinks, we talked about our lives and the role, and he really just understood everything. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like that Ilya Kazan method of casting, where you don't cast an actor, you cast the person. You're looking for the it's like with Tree Grows in Brooklyn. You need a drunk Irishman. Well, you don't get an actor who can play a drunk Irishman. You get a drunk Irishman who is an actor.
Wait, who did play that role?
Yeah, I'm wondering that. I was thinking
his
Mickey
name
Rooney.
Doesn't come to mind right
got
now.
Got Mickey Rooney and got him drunk.
No, sorry I put you on the spot. No, but I get what you're saying. It's getting right to the source and like bypassing.
Saving the trouble of crafting the performance. That's not true.
We're not saying that
you're cutting corners. It's more like you're just finding someone who can be more in line with the character you're trying to create, as opposed to an actor who is not the character, and in creating the character you will miss out on some necessary subtleties that will kind of give a more of a dimension to the acting in the film.
Well, I guess I could compare it that Floyd was, I cast the person, whereas with Mars, what Rinaldi did is he spent plenty of time building this character. He went out, he totally went very method on this one, and he would take jogs at like 3-4 in the morning just to see what it's like to be with no one, just no one around. And he started building his own kind of feelings. But with the guy who played Floyd, he didn't need to do any of that. It was just there.
All right. What about Rhodes?
Well, with Rhodes, I had seen so many women to play this part. It's strange.
We've seen so many women. No, that's not meant to be.
I am raising an eyebrow.
No.
Ethan raised an eyebrow. We have seen a lot of women, and I have to say, that was for the role. It was very difficult to cast these ladies because there were so many
just fantastic
actresses who just really came across with their own interpretation, but it was really what we were looking for, and it made it so difficult to find one. So eventually, it came down to a kind of energy that was unlike anyone else's.
So who I ended up picking was this girl named Kaylee Rose, and what I really loved about her is that she got the character, she had the kind of voice I was looking for, she was beautiful, which is one of the main things I really needed in this character.
It's
is for her to be beautiful.
Because
it works
like
with the symbolism.
Beautiful.
And her eyes were just like blue laser beams just shooting out of her face.
Her eyes were incredible, are incredible in the film. And she can basically act with her eyes. She doesn't really need to say anything. So We saw an early cut of Saltwater, and
yes,
in this early cut, there's a scene where Mars listens into a radio, and, you know, completely inexplicably, there is the recording from Lost, the French recording from Lost. I never watched Lost. I know it's a show about time-traveling polar bears. As I described it to my girlfriend several
time-traveling bunnies,
times.
Actually.
Bunnies.
The
okay.
polar bears never traveled.
That
time.
Makes me want to watch no. it a whole lot more.
Polar bears were on the island. Yes.
They were right. there. Previous. They ate right. fish
Let's
biscuits.
Please just end this. End this. Okay, so recording from Lost. Recording from Lost. Temporary track placement. Can you talk about, just for filmmakers, in case they're making an earlier cut, some advice on how to work things out with the sound? Because occasionally you will be forced to just put in something temporarily. And I got to say, without having seen Lost, it sounds great. It really works. It's the acting is clearly good because, I mean, I guess Lost. Anyway, it works.
It had some good
it's
acting.
It's a good temp track. You talk to filmmakers about just how to do that, how to pick something like that, and how to save time instead of agonizing over finding a French actress to record just 15 seconds of dialogue?
Well, this was a scratch track, and I had two options. Either take this audio loop, which was part of the inspiration of the scene, or, you know, record myself saying it. And quite frankly, I don't speak French that well, and I can't do a woman's voice very well either. So I took it, and I used it as a scratch track, and it raises the production value of the rough cut just so much.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
No, I actually, you know, I'm a big fan of Brian De Palma, for better and worse, and I just recently watched Casualties of War, and during the editing, he, you know, like a lot of directors, takes other people's music and used some Ennio Morricone's music, and he ended up just saying, you know what, I'm going to get this guy to do music. I don't know if you guys have seen Casualties of War,
haven't.
The music... may not be the best part of the movie, but, you know, it's hard for me to question De Palma. And he also was a fan of doing this, though, taking music from other movies, so...
I mean, I doubt we'll hear any recordings from Lost in the final cut of Saltwater, but it definitely is helping Ethan promote the film with a more functional, more professional short.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I just have to paraphrase here, but it's like Jim Jarmusch said, it's like, you know, just devour books, devour old movies. Steal
devour Twitter.
Everything. Yes.
Everything. Steal things.
Steal
which
it.
Is,
take it. Make it your own. They,
yeah, it's great.
They can't
that you're
take it from
that.
You if it's yours.
Mm. It's great that you're saying that, because next we're going to have Ethan stick around and talk to us about Exit Through the Gift Shop, which stealing is an interesting thing to talk about when it comes to this film, now out on DVD and Netflix Instant Play, which is how I imagine most people will watch it. It's a new age. So stick around, and we'll be talking to you about Exit Through the Gift Shop. Let's go ahead and play the trailer right now. It's a really interesting trailer. Even better if you watch it, but you'll have to just content yourself with the sound. So here's the trailer for Exit Through the Gift Shop, a Banksy film. Okay, we're back. Hope you enjoyed that trailer for Exit Through the Gift Shop, the Banksy documentary. A lot of press on this film, a lot of stuff being written about how legitimate it is. What exactly is the story behind Banksy's encounter with
Thierry
Guetta, the French
Well, we can't call him a filmmaker.
He's not a filmmaker.
And we're not sure we'll talk about this later. Is he an artist?
He's accidentally a filmmaker.
Right. And I'm here with two other accidental filmmakers, Ethan Donnelly.
Rick Rosette.
Thank you. I was going to mess up his last name, so I just held back.
Wait, what do you mean when you say accidental filmmakers?
Well, in
what
our
do
case,
I mean? No, yeah. We're here talking
in our
about
case,
it through the gift
just,
shop.
You know, like God-given talent. But back to Thierry Guetta. I don't know. It's one of those names.
He's
just,
like David Guetta, the producer, the DJ producer.
It's just Terry.
It's not Thierry.
Let's call him Terry.
All right, let's call him Terry. All right, so.
He calls himself Terry. So.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some things. Before we really delve too deep, I just want to say there are some incredible moments in this film. One of them I love is when Terry is talking in the beginning about how he got his money with his vintage clothing store, and he's talking about, oh, I would take these shirts and I'd buy them for $50 and I would charge $300, $400. And then as he's saying this, smiling, they cut to a picture of Beck, who I love Beck, but Beck is taking one of, you know, the quote unquote designer shirts and holding it up, and it's a split second in there, but it just it lets you know right from the start this movie is going after celebrities and celebrity culture.
Okay.
Yeah,
before we get into anything else, let's have everybody say what they thought, just because I'll actually just cut right through that and say I really enjoyed the film. I thought it was very entertaining, and that's it. That's it. That's my take on it. I know I'm going to be outnumbered here. I thought it was excellent. I really liked it. I thought it was a grand farce. I am personally confused by the press that's calling it one of the best films of last year, one of the best documentaries, and it's really good. It's very good, but it's not something that I haven't seen done before in this idea of, well, we'll get into that later, but Rick or Ethan, whoever
Ethan,
wants
you
to.
Can go first.
Well, I really enjoyed this film. I personally think it's amazing, and I mean, it doesn't really matter if it's true or not. It's still just a fantastic ride, and it brings you into this very interesting character who's trying to find Banksy, who to him is the most interesting character in the world. But when they meet, Banksy discovers that this person is just so much more interesting than he is. And there's this great just like reversal that happens that's just phenomenal.
Well, this doesn't really have anything to do with what I'm going to say, except for that. Now, see, Banksy considers Terry more interesting, but I don't believe that Terry exactly finds Banksy more interesting. He says that he likes him at one point in the film, but it's just that Banksy has something that Terry has always wanted, and it's not money, it's legitimacy. And we'll talk about this later.
What did you think of the film?
But as far as the film, I really enjoyed it. I don't consider it one of the best films of the year. The film, you know, towards the end there's a part where a guy says, you know, it's this great joke, but I don't really know who the joke's on, and I know who the joke's on, and so because the joke isn't on me as the viewer, I feel like that kind of, you know, brought it down a little. It was that, like, I would even say, like, okay, like, I watched the movie The Fighter. I mean, personally, I was enraptured the whole time, and I really bought into it. So if you're saying, like all movies are kind of like directors playing with the audience, you know, me watching The Fighter, the joke was on me. But in the Banksy, there's like this manipulation between Banksy and Terry. And, you know, there's like the last half hour, you know, there's stuff going on.
When it all
on
comes together.
And to me, I'm just going to put it out there. I think the ultimate joke is on Banksy. Like, I found that Banksy is trying to protect street art, as are the other street artists. And they're saying all this stuff about it. But then you look at the film, Exit Through the Gift Shop, and what does it say right below the title? A Banksy film. Banksy's name is on the film. Banksy, his name isn't on the art, and he says it's not about the money, but he's associated with the art.
And the art does net absurdly large amounts of money.
I'm
going to
agree with you there. There's a line very much towards the end of the film where Banksy says he's talking about Terry's art, and he's comparing it to Warhol. And he says that Warhol used repetition of icons to make them meaningless. And that what Terry does is that he uses repetition of meaningless to make it meaningless. Something along those lines.
Yeah, I remember that. But by the way, go ahead.
Banksy uses repetition of his name so much on this film that it all becomes very meaningless. It's very interesting if you think about it that way.
Well, then the other thing, like, we were talking about is it's a Banksy film, but who shot, you know, 75% of the footage?
Terry.
Now, in Terry talking about it. Terry, we will occasionally refer to him as Mr. Brainwash, which is his legitimate, in quotes, street artist name, so don't get confused. And yeah, Mr. Brainwash shot most of this film as a documentary, and then Banksy kind of appears to jack it, to use that familiar slang term. And you're not sure in the end just where most of that footage comes from, because you got some footage, behind-the-scenes footage of Mr. Brainwash making his show happen, which is an absurd sequence in itself, especially when he breaks his leg and just...
He's riding around in a scooter.
Just has someone, like, push him around while he just splatters paint on things and calls it art. So, yes, that makes me doubt the legitimacy of it, because it's a little too much. It's a little too absurd, and it feels a little too staged. Like, it feels like a Banksy statement, less than Mr. Brainwash is kind of blossoming as this illegitimate, legitimate artist.
Well, there's so much to what you just said. I mean,
I get that a lot.
No, the first thing I want to just say is that I when I was watching the film, I remember seeing the first time they showed it, there's like a piece of artwork that Terry, Mr. Brainwash, does, and it's Elvis holding a machine gun. And I was like, wow, I would buy that.
Fisher Price.
Yes, right. Yeah, and I would just, it's called Don't Be Cruel.
What is that statement?
That's what's so great about it. It's called Don't Be Cruel.
What's the statement? What's the statement?
It's don't use the weapon.
Is it? Because he's holding a Fisher... He's holding a Fisher-Price gun. It feels like he's melding genres and melding famous pieces of art just on a whim. It feels like a man who clearly does not have an artistic aspect to him.
Then why would he call it Don't Be Cruel?
Okay, that's... I can't really argue that.
See, that's
the
thing.
There may be, like, a certain kernel of an artist and at his soul, but, like, what Ethan said about making something meaningless by repeating it so much, this man films every minute of his life that he can. And in seeing this footage, he makes something. We add meaning to it when we watch him play with his kids. But to him, it's all meaningless. To him, the fact that this is what makes me doubt the legitimacy. The fact that he has these tapes locked up in boxes after boxes, and he has no intention of rewatching them. And he's making this street art documentary, in quotes. Well, and he has no intention of watching that either. That just seems unreal to me.
Well, he's doing it though, so these guys will let him keep hanging out with them.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing, is that Terry needs an excuse.
Sure.
So he claims he's shooting a documentary. Sure. And the way the film does that, I think the way it lets the story unfold is just genius, where, like, you even believe that Terry might be a filmmaker. But one thing I got to say is Terry might be the worst videographer I have ever seen in my life. Like, I've seen 4-year-olds holding a cell phone on a train and are better.
They certainly get across that he's bad at what he does.
The scooter footage in Paris is the only good footage that he shot.
I mean, it's something, because this, again, I doubt the legitimacy of it. You establish someone as a poor videographer, and then you have them get in on scenes that are clearly not for your, like, for their eyes only, for the eyes of these street artists. Like, he'll climb the rooftops, and he'll go with them to these abandoned places, and you feel like you're peering in on something that's very private. And then you get to Banksy, and you have these big installations, and it becomes less private, and it becomes more commercial.
So you don't, now the film does like a really you know, like, they really try, they put a great effort into making you believe that there's this moment where Banksy really just trusts Terry and throws everything into Terry, and I'm of course referencing the Disneyland,
right?
The Disney,
I think that was an accident more than a, that feels like an accident to me more than it feels like a,
The film does, like, they really try, though, at that moment. Like, you know, you have Banksy shrouded in darkness with that
permanently, though.
Voice
permanently.
Modulator. Yeah, through the whole film. But it's, like, during that sequence, he's, like, and that's where I trusted Terry, you know, and it's
he's
just
got
like
kind of British wit. he's kind of like a young John. If John Cleese could like fuck around with people,
yeah, no, one thing
just
about
in a hoodie,
Banksy also, I don't know if you guys noticed, like, I think there's like a bottle of Cavassier underneath him.
A what?
A bottle. There's like a bottle of Cavassier, like in silhouette. But I'm a huge like cognac fan, so I looked and I was like, this guy's drinking. Like he's obviously drinking to be on this interview. I don't know if you see it again. Sorry, that's like
that's interesting. I'll keep an eye out for that piece of alcohol trivia.
Yeah, there you go. You know, it might come in handy.
But just to address that Disneyland thing, I mean, yeah, I guess it is a story about Mr. Brainwash and Banksy and their relationship, but it never really closed. Like the book gets closed on that, where Banksy never puts a trick over in Mr. Brainwash. It's the other way around.
Mm.
But what happens is Banksy comes out of it kind of like clean, because as much as we see of Banksy's art, like he's sort of like a righteous god of street artists. Like he'll print a million pounds and in cash, and he won't use it because he understands that it'll cause chaos.
Well,
remember that scene where he shows it off?
Yeah.
I mean, and then he'll like, that's a little thing, but you understand the fact that he shows it to you, and you understand what the capacity to cause carnage might be of that stunt. And then you have Mr. Brainwash, who's not causing the same kind of damage, but he puts out this gallery that mixes styles at a whim and basically kind of makes you feel bad about art for a little bit.
Well, the last half hour, I don't know how it is to you guys, but the last half hour of Exit Through the Gift Shop is just, it's painful, because Terry, the way they paint him, is just so aloof, and he's just like such a marketer, and he has no talent. And they're saying all this stuff, and it, you know, the people working on the installation are like, I would never work on another
really
hate installation.
I got the same feeling of discomfort as I did watching Borat try to like squeeze the bit of air out of his manager's buttocks and no, seriously, honestly, that was the same kind of discomfort, because you're feeling like somebody's being stripped naked, and just kind of, you're watching a man make a fool of himself, but there's no point at which he realizes that he just goes full blast. And then what's particularly painting to Banksy, I assume, as well as to the viewer, is you see him succeed. You see him succeed in spite of the fact that you've been looking at this art and you're thinking to yourself, my God, what's he thinking? Some of these pieces just make no sense. Never mind the fact that it's not his artistry, it's the artistry of other artists who never found fame, who he hires to work as essentially a slave driving team. It's like Banksy's Simpsons intro. He did a Simpsons intro that's just, I don't know if you guys have seen it.
Yeah.
You've seen it?
No.
Okay, definitely check it out. It shows how the Simpsons get made in Korea. And
it would honestly make you feel bad.
Yeah. And there was a writer who threatened to quit over it. It was a real big deal. But he designed it, and he really stands behind his own property. It doesn't look like he has a team that works on this stuff, but he seems to preside over them. What Terry, Mr. Brainwash, ends up doing is he kind of stands back, and he goes like, oh, you guys create this, you guys create that. This is all mine. I'm Mr. Brainwash. This is all my work. Never mind. You're just kind of like, you know, there's a totem pole. And with Banksy, it feels like he's just holding up the totem pole. Mr. Brainwash feels like he's standing on top of a lot of people who did the actual work, and he's claiming it to be his own because he hatched an idea that, frankly, a lot of the time seems premature.
Yeah. Well, I mean, God, I'm just thinking about that Madonna reference at the end. Now she had Mr. Brainwash do the cover, and it's art that's seen
in
the gallery.
It's crazy because you can actually – I looked at the cover afterwards, and I was like, my God, this is his style, I guess, because you recognize his style immediately.
But that, and see, this goes back to my point, is that, and I feel like that, you know, Banksy is trying to make a statement about Madonna and kind of lower her, because, you know, I think this is a woman who is known for like jumping on to different trends and everything. But I've always had a defense of Madonna, because like, she jumped on to dance music, but she got like that producer Miroir, who's like this French producer, makes great music. Like, he's not known over here, and over there she might be a joke for doing it, but it worked. It sold a bunch of records, and this guy is a great producer. And, like, the Guy Ritchie thing, indefensible. But
the man did make, what was it? between Snatch and
Swept Away.
That is
indefensible.
That is grounds for divorce.
Yes. Great
but,
song.
Yeah, that is a great song. Great song. And yes, as a trailer whore, as I was earlier labeled, not in this podcast, in real life, that song is used to great effect in the Burn After Reading trailer, so check that out.
But, okay, so Ethan, I've noticed, you know, you've kind of taken a step back for a minute. I just want to get your opinion. How do you feel about the end of the film where everyone is trying to kind of summon up their feelings on Terry's success? How did you feel about that?
Well, it can all really be sort of summed up with what Banksy says, that he used to encourage all his friends, go out and make art. He doesn't really do that anymore. It's sort of like where Banksy just told Mr. Brainwash, go out and, you know, try to make some art. Mr. Brainwash went out and he made what he thought was art by taking all the things he knew was art and then just making that again. And in the end, you just have this great kind of like opposition between the two forces of just Banksy, who's well-respected, stands behind, does things that he believes in. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Brainwash, who is, in the end, painting Life is Beautiful on a brick wall.
That crumbles.
And then or it's like knocked over with a forklift.
But the thing is, how did Banksy become famous to, like, a worldwide audience?
I believe it was paintings in the Met.
It was sticking paintings in the Met and painting on the...
On that wall. On
the wall between Israel
and... Gaza Strip, is that
where
it is?
In Gaza Strip, yeah. That's what really catapulted... I remember reading about him and thinking, wow, that's really...
The paintings in the Met, though,
that's interesting.
Is just...
The paintings in the Met is hilarious. Phenomenal. And you see the footage, and that must be the real thing. And that's he really got one over. And then for someone whose face and identity are still unknown, I mean, I read a message board post that suggested that Mr. Brainwash and Banksy are the same guy, and that's far-fetched, but it makes for a really fascinating film to consider the duality.
Well, Terry and Banksy can't be the same person, but Mr. Brainwash could be Banksy.
It's very possible.
I hadn't really thought about it. Like, I guess where I'm kind of differing with you guys on this is I'm totally questioning, I really like Banksy's art, and I am into it. I do feel like all the hype and all the money put to it was just insane. You know what I mean? Just like how I felt when I was a little kid and I heard, like, Van Gogh's Starry Night sold for, like, over $1 million. Like, as a little kid, it bothered me. As an adult, you know, finding out this street art sells for this much bothers me. But I'm not trying to tear down Banksy's art. I appreciate it. But what I don't appreciate is Banksy tearing down Terry's art, because it's not like a little kid could paint something on a wall and I wouldn't believe that's art, and a graffiti artist might do it and it might not look good, but like the deeper thing and what I'm getting at is what is the art? Like, how is Banksy able to judge this art because what, like, he believes in it and, you know, he established himself. What is it about Banksy that makes it so he can say what is art and what Terry does isn't art?
I don't think he ever does, though. I think he just shows you what Terry is doing without a particular bias. And you recognize it. If there is a bias, it's very clearly in the way that it's cut. But Banksy never exhibits a bias to what Terry's doing, aside from a few snide comments that I expect from him. But the reality is, you see what Terry's doing, your response to it seems to be natural. And some people may find what he's doing to be art, and may find Banksy to be incorrect. And that's the beauty of this documentary, is that it inspires discussion. Otherwise, we wouldn't be having the discussion right now.
That's true. Otherwise, we'd be talking about, you know...
Season of the Witch, the new Nicolas Cage film.
There's
don't
potential.
See
there,
it.
There's
don't
potential
see
we
it.
Talk
Wait
about
till
it,
Drive so. Angry. It's in 3D. He drives his car out of hell to fight the devil to save his baby daughter. Right?
I don't know anything about that, but I will go see Season of the Witch, playing Season of the Witch on my iPod the entire time.
That's awful.
It'll probably be a better film for
yeah,
it.
Yeah, maybe.
Too.
Ron Perlman's nice. In that.
I love Ron Perlman, and I don't know why he's in that movie. That makes me feel
Everybody
bad.
Needs a paycheck.
Oh, man.
And Beauty Sorry. And the Beast just doesn't pay the bills anymore.
All right, so coming back, just a couple other things I want to touch on with Exit to the Gift Shop. You know, we live in this culture... reality film stars. I feel Terry is like the ultimate reality TV star, reality film star. How do you guys view him? Like, would you agree with that statement?
I don't know how to feel about what you just said. It's sort of like this complicated idea that I don't even know how to justify in the film, but kind of, you have this person who's clearly has mental problems. I mean, the film shows you that he is not quite right in the head. And I don't know if you have any relatives who film everything.
No, I don't.
Film everything for no reason, just put it in a shoebox, never going to look at it again. But reality TV star, I guess, he's sort of...
He's a product of a culture of reality
TV. Well, the whole thing is this. One thing we often talk about with like reality TV and reality TV stars is, do these people actually have talent? We often question. I mean, let's even look at someone like, and I don't want to pick on her, but Ashley Simpson. Like, there's this great thing in a Chuck Klosterman interview we did with Rick Rubin, where Rick Rubin says he went out to eat Mr. Chow's, and he was like, I just saw someone over there at a table, and this person is a celebrity, but I don't know what they do. And people were like, are they a singer? And he was like, no. Are they a movie star? No. You know, well, do they do the theater? And they went through like every popular thing, and he couldn't say what she did, and it turned out it was Ashley Simpson. And that's kind of like a reality star, and that's kind of like Terry. It's like, well, is Terry a filmmaker? Well, he shot this footage, but he can't edit it. He doesn't know. And is Terry an artist? Well, he makes art, but he's doing the same thing over and over, and it's just like, you know, is Terry's not necessarily legitimate at everything else, so what is he good at? He's good at marketing.
He's good at getting people to do things for him. I think. And he gets Banksy to do a documentary for him. That's one way to look at it.
I would not agree with that statement.
What do you mean, is getting Banksy to do it for him?
That he made Banksy make the film for him? I mean,
well, that's not quite what I mean, but go ahead.
And I saw that there was only... Here's a man who somehow, by a miraculous accident, got let into a very, very tight community where they frown upon, you know, filming.
Obviously, because they're doing something illegal.
They're doing things that are illegal. And here's a man who is they let him film. He has some of the only footage. And they're not going to let another person come in and film again. I mean, quite frankly, Banksy had a duty to get this film out. Because as you saw in the film, Life Remote Control.
Which is the greatest film title of all time. Worst film, great title.
Speaking of Life Remote Control, a co-editor on Life Remote Control is suing Exit Through the Gift Shop now.
For stealing some of his footage.
That's right, which makes perfect sense and casts legitimacy on it further, or doesn't, because if he came out of the woodwork and said, hey, you're stealing some of my footage, it could either be a plan by Banksy, or it could be a legitimate guy who feels like he got the cold shoulder on this documentary. Well, kind of like that... Kazaki Village in Borat. Again, Borat.
You know, everything comes back to Sacha Baron Cohen.
Well, he made a documentary that is not a documentary. It's a comedy, but I have not seen any film that kind of created that kind of discussion. Borat was incredibly puerile and kind of stupid, but it created a discussion between people for how ridiculous it was, because it highlighted certain aspects of American society that we don't like to talk about. Exit Through the Gift Shop takes a bigger look at art in general, and also creates an opportunity to ask some questions that otherwise we wouldn't be talking about, as in like commercialism in art and understanding if there is a standard of quality in something that's created by an artist, or how someone qualifies himself as an artist. I mean, it's a lot of questions.
No, I mean, and sadly we aren't going to be able to answer them today.
Well, I do want to put one thing out there, is that there is this interesting transformation of Terry as he starts off as being this cool kind of businessman who can turn $50 of damaged clothing into $5,000, to the end where he's this businessman artist, Philip Seymour Hoffman-esque person.
Oh my God. Mr. Hoffman, you've really given us a lot of material this podcast.
Yeah, but you were not drinking the Terry Guetta Philip Seymour Hoffman-esque milk, though. If you sided with Banksy at the end.
Well, to be fair, I did side with Banksy at the end. Because it's sort of like this quote from Kipling, where it's pretty.
Rudyard Kipling.
Yeah.
Who wrote.
Yeah, you know his work.
Okay.
It's pretty, but is it art?
Uh-huh.
And it's just like, quite frankly, Terry's art wasn't even that pretty.
No.
And it's just the bare minimum of art.
There was a robot made out of televisions.
Which
was great,
been,
though. You guys
would have been
like
cool
that?
If that wasn't the first. If that was the first time I've ever seen that, that would have been amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't
but,
know. I
like,
loved
I feel
it.
Like
I saw
MTV
it. I
did
it.
That in the 80s.
I feel like somewhere something has been done. That's another topic worth talking about. But look, see Exit Through the Gift Shop, Netflix Instant Play, DVD. Watch. There's probably a good amount of special features. Maybe they even have a cut of Life Remote Control. We have to look that up.
Please
if
don't
they,
watch that.
Yeah, if they do, just avoid it. Avoid it. But keep an eye on this film because its story is not yet over. It's definitely going to... We're going to hear some more about it because Banksy's... I don't think Banksy's the type to just let it go. It's a big project for him, like anything else he does. So maybe we'll find ourselves talking about Exit Through a Gift Shop 2. Maybe not. Probably
not.
Yeah.
Probably Enter Through the Gift Shop.
Nice.
It would be a prequel.
Nice. All right. Well, that takes care of it. We're going to bid goodbye to Ethan. Ethan, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me, you guys.
And Ethan, I know you don't have a set date for a cut that could be online, but we'll be looking for it whenever you post something. And
look for Saltwater online or hopefully at a local or hopefully regional, maybe even worldwide festival. Time will tell. But that said... Ethan is a great guest, and perhaps we'll have him on the show again. Depends on, hopefully, you'll make a couple more films or more.
Or he could just come and talk about Time Away, so is The Room.
Yeah, we'll need to have you on here.
I've never
do.
Actually seen The Room. I tried watching it once, and I just can't get past the mentally challenged kid who keeps walking in on them having
Whether
sex.
Denny is mentally challenged is arguable. As
He's
a,
mentally challenged.
Wait, guys,
well,
that's another podcast.
Yes, another podcast. So look for our The Room podcast. Now, it's about that time to wrap it up, and Rick and I have a segment that we like to call homework, and it's real simple.
Yeah, we finished film school, but we want to keep pushing ourselves to see new movies, think about new things.
And we're just going to go ahead and make suggestion for the week. And we are looking to do this podcast on a week-by-week basis, looking to put in time. And we'll go and see that film the other person suggested, no matter what it is, even if we've already seen it, and come back and talk about it some. Just give up some thoughts, you know? So, Rick, you can go first. What's your suggestion
for
this week? All
right, the homework assignment for you, Mark, it's Monty Hellman's classic Tulane Blacktop. Have you seen the movie?
I have not, but I have heard great things, so
wow.
I'll be happy to see it.
Well, one thing about the film is, I don't want to ruin it for you, but I know you, when you often talk about films with me at least, you say, I was emotionally invested or I wasn't emotionally invested. In this film... you will not be emotionally invested. The director does what he can to make you not be emotionally invested, and then, of course, by the end, you are. So it's like a challenge to the viewer. It's a great statement about America in the early 70s. We were pushing into a different era, and it also features one of the great film performances of all time by Warren Oates, underrated actor. His name is GTO, and I just can't wait for you to see it.
Okay. Sounds good. I'll be checking it out. And my homework assignment for you is, now, bear with me, I might get a few things wrong, but it's a 2003 Korean film, South Korean, John Bon-ho film. I probably got that name wrong. Memories of Murder. Now, John Bon-ho is a very prolific director. He has directed some of my favorite South Korean films, and he's one of the foremost filmmakers coming out of South Korea. He's directed The Host. He has directed, I believe he directed Mother most recently. Yes, he did direct Mother.
That was
Mother.
A movie on a lot of top 10 lists.
Right, exactly. And Memories of Murder is a police procedural, very different from most that I've seen. It's part slapstick, part grisly murder drama, and it just has such a devastating feel to it. And it's based apparently on true facts about South Korea's first well-known, well-publicized series of serial killings, which began in the 80s. Wow. And some great performances, incredible cinematography, and just such an odd film, such a brilliant film. After I saw it, it took me some time to get around to it, but I find it to be more involving and in the end better than Silence of the Lambs, just by a little bit. I know it's a really crazy thing to say, but see it and decide for yourself.
All right. Well,
so 2003's Memories of Murder. I probably got the director wrong, but I'm pretty sure it's John Bonhu.
Well,
Bonhu.
I'm excited. And Mark, it was great working with you.
Absolutely. Rick, till next time, this is the Brooklyn Film Theorists, and we'll play you out with The Man
by Top Dollar Roz.
I'm Papa Joe Jackson. I don't give a fraction. I'm what you pay to see, like a paralyzed backstreet. Welcome to the faction. Let me bring the facts. You don't want drama, cause I bring the action. Ask them, top dollars like a Unabomber. I got them all scared in the hotel Rwanda. Trying to survive, I'm suggesting that you hide. Cause I'm performing whack, rapper mass genocide. I know that you're sick of them. Come and get your medicine. I'm the most feared, revered of all reverence. Cause I bring the gospel, brand new. Testament, it's one sentence long. It don't please, don't. There's not an.